Ladies and gentlemen, it is time, and we are back. Welcome to Sparkwood and 21, the No Ship Network podcast on the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/noship. And today we are recommending Diane, the Twin Peaks tapes of Agent Cooper. And this Audible book is brought to you by Lynch Frost Productions and narrated by Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, very cool.
If you are listening to No Ship Network for the first time and you want to know more about us, you can head over to our website at noship.net and you can find the other podcasts that we produce on other television series such as American Gods, Handmaid's Tale, Penny Dreadful, Vikings, etc. And you can also find more of our content through the TV Time app, which is a free app you can download on your smartphone. It gives you access to podcasts as well as connects you with a worldwide community, and it also gives you notifications to when your shows are going to air, which is helpful in this day of streaming our content.
You know, sometimes shows will take a break for 2 weeks, and instead of like going on your TV guide or looking, you can just look in your TV Showtime app and it'll tell you how long the break's for.
Before we get started, I would just like to make a public service announcement. Just like to please warn everybody, for the remainder of the podcast, please stay on the bike.
All right, so we are discussing The Return of Twin Peaks, Part 1. My log has a message for you, and this was written by David Lynch and Mark Frost, of course, and directed by David Lynch. Any thoughts on this part before we get started?
It'd be quicker to tell you what we didn't think. Actually,
right.
Oh man. We ended up watching, Em and I ended up watching this in all four parts all at once, mm-hmm. that were available that night. So it was a blur in my mind of just a big smile on my face and lots of question marks and just this general feeling of awesomeness that's washing over you because you're watching Twin Peaks again. But going back and watching this episode to get serious about it and to take notes and everything, it's just pure genius from top to bottom. What did you think?
Man, that was the best television experience I've ever had. And it's not just because it's Twin Peaks. It truly was the best television experience I've ever had. And I was up way past my bedtime just so I could do that, you know, because I had to go to work the next day. And I went into work groggy, and it was so worth it. And I remember I was like just stumbling down the hallway, and my coworker was like, "So, how was Twin Peaks?" And I was like, "It was a wild ride." As far as like preparing for this podcast, it was so fun. This is probably the most fun I've had preparing for a podcast. I have not been as excited as I am right now to podcast on a show.
I didn't know what to expect. You know, it's been like a couple months, not too long, since I'd watched any Twin Peaks, and they kind of snuck into where at the beginning, you know, you have different scenes, and then they throw in the theme song, and it actually relaxed me a little bit. I don't know if it did for you guys. It was like, oh, okay. And you know, I get distracted sometimes, and I'll give this show one thing. It kept me focused and watching it completely all the way through. Because every time I would kind of like look over to the side or whatever, they would be in a, you know, that little room with the glass window, or they would, something else would be going on. It was a fun ride for sure. And even on the second watch, I enjoyed it, I think, even more, which is phenomenal. You know, I loved it.
So many questions, though, were answered just by watching it a second time and paying a little bit closer attention. Mm-hmm. I thought that I would have a lot more questions just going through the whole thing. Like, wait a minute, who's this? What are they doing? What happened here? And that's what I thought going in. And then once I watched it, I was like, oh yeah, there's definitely going to be some questions. And then on rewatch, a lot of it gets answered. So there's still some stuff that I just can't make heads or tails out of. And some things are very cryptic and it's intentional, obviously. But, that second watch really gets you to the point where you can go, okay, this is all making sense if you slow down and kind of take it in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Steve already mentioned that we watched all four parts that night. We are not going to touch on part three or part four.
We're going to stay spoiler free. Just going to discuss parts one and two today.
Which is new for Sparkwood, because usually we spoil the shit out of Twin Peaks, but we will not at this point. All right, so we start out with the Black Lodge scene. We have Agent Del Cooper in the Black Lodge, and it's Laura Palmer, and she says, "I'll see you in 25 years. And then she says, "Meanwhile." So we're all familiar with that particular scene. And I underline "meanwhile" because I think we're actually seeing meanwhile. So we haven't gotten to the 25-year point yet.
That's a good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought of that. I thought it was just kind of like, meanwhile, time gets suspended, 25 years goes by, and then we start where we're at now with an aged Cooper, and he's talking to the giant. So do you think it's the scene with the giant that is in the meantime, or do you think that's this time?
I don't know. It was just, it could be everything we're seeing.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's this time. That's just me, you know, because it's in black and white. This is where I need you guys. So this is going to be questions coming from me. The giant, is he a part of the Black Lodge or is he something else? That's something I meant to ask on a preview. You know, does anybody know?
Nope.
Because I don't think I'd ever seen him actually in there before, did I?
Yes, you have.
We did. Okay, so mm-hmm. Good. This is important. All right, fantastic.
Well, there's the part where he says one and the same. And he's mm-hmm. talking about him in the arm, the man from another place being...
And then the arm comes up and touches Mike mm-hmm. like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Yeah, because that's one of the reasons why I felt also that it was in the present, because he was giving him more clues and telling him things, and then he disappears, and then we get him with the one-armed man on the couch, right?
Yeah, that comes a little bit later. Mm-hmm. And you know, the one-armed man is talking about past or present, which is
exactly.
that kind of thing. So... You know, and time is loopy, literally and figuratively, in the Black mm-hmm. Lodge. So we really don't know where we're at any point. But I like what you're saying, though, about the black and white. That was kind of a signifier to me that,
yeah.
And then when he says, you are far away, and then Cooper disappears. So is he disappearing and then reappearing in another part of the Black Lodge? Or is this like his journey out? Or at what point in time is that? I mean, they could be mm-hmm. messing with us, and that could have been at the point right before he goes back into reality. So,
yeah, real cool.
But before we get into the new title credits, we have more images from the original Twin Peaks. We have images of the high school. We have that girl that was running and crying after the rumors of Laura's death were starting to spread around the school. And then we have the camera zoom in on Laura's homecoming picture. And then we cut to... opening credits. And now we have new imagery, but the same song. It's cool because the red curtains are now waving in this way where it's like a stand-in for the flowing water that we used to have instead. And then we have the spinning chevron floor, which is, I think, meant to make us feel a little discombobulated. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's how they're... brainwashing into us into liking the show even more. There's subliminal messages in that floor spinning.
it's like we're falling into a chevron whirlpool or something.
Right.
So now we're to the scene that we were just talking about with the giant, who's played by Carl Stroken, which Steve and I have met. He's a very nice fellow.
Very tall.
Yes, very tall. Steve, you wrote down what he said.
Yes, he tells Cooper, 430 Richard and Linda, two birds with one stone. And to me, this was all very cryptic clues, obviously, and it reminded mm-hmm. me of the Zen episode from season one, where we're talking about Jack with one eye and all that kind of stuff, and Cooper's getting together a way to figure all this other stuff out. And he even says, I understand. We don't, but he does, so at least somebody's on the right page.
Yeah, thank goodness.
But before that, though, he says, listen to the sounds, and there's a phonograph,
mm-hmm.
and... at first, it sounds like something's trying to scratch or scrabble its way out.
Yeah.
But if you really listen to it, you can see that it's actually a repetitive sound. And I think you can barely make out that it's actually somebody trying to say something. And I don't know, but I think one of the words is Auf Wiedersehen, which means I will see you again.
Yeah.
And Laura says in the opening scene, I will see you again in 25 years. And the significance of it being in German, Deutsch, you know, we had a mysterious, unexplained scene in Twin Peaks where Major Briggs shows up dressed like the Red Baron, like he had been time traveling.
That's right.
So I'm going to stick to the idea that I heard Auf Wiedersehen.
I like it. I like it because I couldn't make anything out of it, so I'm good with that.
I kept rewinding it and listening real closely. We don't understand what the giant said after that. We already to discuss that. So that hopefully will soon be revealed to us as far as what the meanings are behind those cryptic statements.
I think that's going to be a season-long type thing.
Yeah.
Just like with the smiling bag and stuff like that.
And then that's when he says, "You are far away." And then we see Cooper demanifest, or whatever you want to call it. And so now we finally get to see our first Twin Peaks local, and it's Dr. Jacoby, and he's receiving a delivery. And it's curious because he steps out of his trailer.
Yeah.
And then he takes his sunglasses off that are over his blue and red glasses.
Right.
So why does he have them on inside but not outside?
Maybe he was welding on the inside. I don't know. Ah. I mean,
he could
it works.
He could
but I think it's dangerous to weld in a trailer. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe he was in one of those rooms like he had at his other apartment in Twin Peaks where it was just all Hawaii-based, you know, and he's got the...
Sunbathing?
He's got the sunlight on so bright that he needs his shades because he's sitting there listening to the Hawaii music.
Cradling his coconut.
Yeah, cradling his coconut with Laura's necklace in there. And then he's just... then he goes out into the muted kind of... sheltered sunlight of a northeastern afternoon, yeah. or I'm sorry, a northwestern afternoon, and he doesn't need him, so he takes him off.
All right. I like that idea. So anything, so in his delivery is shovels.
Yeah. And he's inspecting them. You know, he like actually turns around and looks at each of them. I don't know if you guys noticed. So no bunk shovels in this batch.
Well, it's a nice meditative look at it. There's not a lot going on, so it's a prolonged shot. Which, you know, we have all throughout this show, which I really, really like. And it's great for note taking.
Yeah, it gives you time to go. You don't have to keep pausing it as much when you're doing your recap. That's good. Thank you, Lynch. We appreciate that. So the guy who's dropping off the shovel says, "So you need some help?" And he's like, "Nah, I like to work alone." So what the hell is he doing with a whole box of shovels out there?
Well, we don't know if he's practicing or not anymore. I mean, It's Twin Peaks in the woods. You know, you got to be special to live out there anyway after everything else that's happened.
Well, according to the secret history of Twin Peaks, he lost his license.
Dr. J, no longer a doctor.
So now we have a beautiful aerial shot of New York City. I think it's the most gorgeous aerial shot I've ever seen of that city.
Yeah, I agree. And it's almost like they turned up the lights to make it look even more electric, kind of like a circuit board, you know?
It looked like lava.
It was absolutely beautiful.
It was one of the more striking scenes I've seen of the New York City skyline at night, because you see it in movies. I mean, how many movies have you seen with that exact same thing? Mm-hmm. But just seeing it this way made it look so much more appealing.
It's like they had the camera tilted down a little more. Usually if you get across New York City, this had that cool, almost like downward angle to it.
Right.
It was fantastic.
So you start with that aerial shot, but then... Mm-hmm. The next shot is coming from below. It ascends upward. And we're seeing this building. And as you go up the building, you see that the top of the building is bricked out, all the windows, kind of like you would see Masonic lodges.
Mm.
And then, and so this is where that mysterious room is located with the glass box on the inside. You can't see the glass box at this point from the outside of the building.
Yeah.
So what a job would this be? You know, to just sit on a couch and sip coffee and just watch. Nobody's...
Yeah, see, I'm a little paranoid. So they're going to tell me it's an easy job. And, like, you know, I get what this guy's doing. But then I'm going to ask, what's going to happen in the box? You know? And look, I would have been right. I would have been right. So there's no... I don't think I would have taken it. It's just too weird. It's too easy and too weird. You know, your Scooby sense has to go off on these kinds of jobs every now and then.
And you'd be like, why me?
Yeah, what?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Why did you call me back out of all the applicants?
Yeah. You're the most expendable.
Yeah. Well, Steve, according to our records, nobody's going to miss you if you die in this job. No. That's not what I meant to say.
So we get a lot of different shots of this glass box. We see it up close and we see it from various perspectives. We even see where you're back from it, and you see how large the box is in relation to Sam, who sits across from it. This box is enormous. Then there's a woman's voice who says camera 3. So Sam gets up and he has to take a memory card out of, label it, replace it, and go put camera 3's memory card in a large black safe that has a red doorknob.
Yeah.
So this, I'm assuming that the cameras go off at the slightest anything that changes inside that box, there's going to be, and then his job is basically to take the video or photo logging of that and file it away in the proper place.
So you don't think it's videoing and it's just announced, it knows it's about to be full and he just has to change out the card?
That's what I think for sure, that it has like a time limit when that camera's up and full.
Yeah.
Because nowadays with those types of equipment, you know, it records in 1080p and you can stop it where you want to. You know what I mean? And then it probably has something that marks when something moves in the box. So like it's going to be continually and then a little like timestamp. You know what I mean? So he just goes in and just changes them out. It's pretty impressive when they open, you could tell it's been going on a while because when he puts the memory card in, it's kind of towards the middle and there's a lot of room for each little card to go in. So it's been going on for quite some time.
Are we going to see a warehouse full of those black boxes like you do at the end of Indiana Jones?
I hope so. I hope so. That'll be the end. Somebody's pushing it into place.
And then you see the arc and it starts to burn through a box.
That's cheesy. I would love it.
So there's an announcement of a delivery because you actually hear the elevator come up and all that. And now we meet Tracy and the guard sitting outside.
She wants to get into that room in the worst way.
Oh,
She thinks coffee's going to do the trick, but it's, you know, she's going to have to do better than that. The guard's going to have to be gone. That's what I was saying.
Yeah, that guard's giving her stink eye the entire time.
But it's interesting because Steve brought this to my attention, and I've been watching David Lynch for a long time, and I never really thought about that particular acting style that's happening being unique to Lynch's work. And you're absolutely right about that.
You notice how she acts. Tracy acts. She's just like, so, you think there's any way I could get in there? And he's like, oh, damn, shoot, no. You know, and the guard says no. And the acting style is just really, it's what David Lynch wants out of his actors, but it's not what you traditionally refer to as, like, good acting, to where you just let people go and do what they do, their craft. He's telling them how to do this. Like,
I think what they're saying comes off not as stellar acting, but what they're expressing does. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they're at odds.
So you think like their body movements and their facial expressions are hitting the mark where the what's coming out of their mouths is almost like a distraction from that?
Yeah. It's hard to describe, but it's definitely, I think, unique to his work. Okay, it's made plain that she can't go in. So she's about to leave, and then he's about to go into the door, and she's watching him type in the buttons, and he notices it, and Sam turns to her, and he says, you are a bad girl, Tracy. And then she says, try me.
I would have turned to the guard and be like, I'm going to need to go on break for 15 minutes. No, wait, five.
Let's be realistic. This is only going to take 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep going. That's so Lynchian and all that, but those two lines are not only Lynchian, but they're Twin Peakian, specifically to Twin Peaks. I want to say, you know, I'm pretty sure something similar happened between Laura and another character.
Twin Peakian, trademark, No Ship Network. No,
yeah.
All right, so we get our next Twin Peaks local visitation. I guess you can't really call it. We're visiting, so I guess you can call it our visitation.
That's a good way to look at it. It's a visitation at this point because I feel like this show is going to start off. Well, it already shown us that it is going to start off super expansive with all these other places, and I think it's going to slowly circle back in and condense down to where at some point all of the action is going to be in Twin Peaks, or at least that's what I think. That's what I hope as well.
So we're at the Great Northern. And we've got Benjamin Horn in his office, and it doesn't look like very much has changed at all, except he's aged some. And Ashley Judd comes in. She's playing Beverly. So I thought she's going to play Donna, but nope. That's okay. But apparently there's a woman who was upset because there was a skunk in the hotel. But I thought it was funny because Beverly asked Ben Horn, how did the skunk get into her room? And he says, what's that? And she repeats herself. And I think he thought she said, how did the cunt get into her room? Because if you listen, it sounds like that at first. And that's, again, classic Lynch. I'm going to hate myself. I'm going to say that so many times.
Just edit it out whenever you don't like it, because you're going to say it a lot more than you're going to be able to stop yourself from saying it, you know, because it really is. It's hard to find other descriptors for that, but it is classic Lynch, you know. So what do you do? It's neo-classic Lynch.
And then we have Jerry Horn make his entrance, which you hear him before you see him.
Oh, yeah. The way it's supposed to be.
Exactly.
This makes perfect sense to me because Jerry Horn, being a pothead and a pot grower, I mean, think about how much he was into food in the original series.
Exactly.
He was all about, you know, brie sandwiches and, Ben, you got to try this, you know, and just going on and on about food. I mean, who better in this show to have one thing go with the other? So
he's going to be like Mr. Miyagi and even Cowgirls Get the Blues. Ha, ha, ho, ho, he.
Well, yeah. It cracked me up because his brother didn't want any part of it. He's like, oh, thank God you're not in the hotel business anymore. You know, it made me laugh.
Yeah, because he's disappointed in him eating his own profits. And Jerry's like, mm-hmm. Where have you been, Ben? Apparently, he's doing quite well with his business. But I cracked up when after Beverly left, Jerry's like asking, are you giving it to her? Ben responds with R-E-S-P-E-C-T, and Jerry says, sock it to me, sock it to me, sock it to me. That's part of the same song, so that was, mm-hmm. I thought, hilarious.
Well, his brother's acting all hoity-toity kind of, but at the same time, he calls him out because eventually he kind of lets his hand go like, oh, I'm not going to do that because of respect and all, but he's like, well, she's married. So obviously he's looked into it too. So
I think we're supposed to think that Ben has stayed a changed man ever since the ordeal with, like after the Civil War crap. Mm-hmm. And he got the cigar back and dropped the celery stick, thank God. But he's still in that mind frame of like, okay, I can be a better person. I just need to be straightforward about this and that. But he's also being mm-hmm. a little bit naive because here's Brother Jerry over here who's tripling the family fortune's profits because of his legalized business venture at this point, where yeah. here's Ben being the conservative, like, well, I'm just going to stick with the hotel business, which I'm sure he does fine at, but it's probably more lucrative than trying to get involved with Ghostwood Estates and, you know, setting things on fire and trying to stay away from the law and things like that. So
I took it as Jerry's calling him on his bullshit because he knows who Ben really is.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And Jerry is still true to himself. He's very much into eating food and having a good time. And I think probably he has the best lines of this episode.
Yeah.
Because even
yeah.
when he eats the banana bread and he says wheels up because he's about to get high, I thought that was funny. And then we end the scene with a non sequitur, which is also classic to Twin Peaks. That's when Ben says, is that Mother's hat? End of scene. So now we're at the Twin Peaks Sheriff Station. And we have a man who's only known as Man in Suit come up to the front desk where Lucy is still manning to this day. And he can't seem to say much beyond it's about insurance and requesting for just Sheriff Truman. I think this is important because I don't even know if that guy's human at this point, just based on everything I've watched. More on that later.
He's like a malfunctioning robot that can only say stuff about insurance.
Yeah, I think there's something inhuman about him.
And you think? Yeah. I just figured she was frustrating him and it took him off guard because he's asking for the sheriff and she's like, which one? There's usually only one sheriff in any town. There's a sheriff and a lot of deputies. So I took it as it just totally took him off guard and he was like, well, I just need to talk to the sheriff. You know, here's the card. And she's looking at him kind of spacey like, okay.
The way he spoke, like, hovered on the human side of Glitchy is the only way I could describe it.
Yeah, I mean, I could totally see what you're saying.
I was just happy to see that her nameplate up there said Lucy Brennan.
Yeah.
So they got married and they had a kid and they got to live happily ever after. So
yeah.
But I also think her line is really important because she says, which one? It could make a difference. And so since we're dealing with a show that's about duality, that's
for sure
a very pregnant line, right? So after the scene, we are startled by some heavy percussion and we're on a dark road at night, lit with headlights, and there's distortion in the music, the vocals specifically, and it reminds me of something that the Melvins would actually make.
Yeah, I agree with that. It sounds like one of the weirder Melvin songs. Like you said, you're right. I agree.
So now we meet the man in black, Bad Coop.
Oh my God. This is crazy.
I remember when we watched it, I was like, oh my God.
This is like simultaneously the worst and the best version of Kyle MacLachlan I've ever seen. Right? You know?
He's got that kind of dark suntan skin and the greasy hair.
He's been living it black up hole in his own eyes. Style this last 25 years yeah. since he oh, got yeah. out of the lodge.
So he walks outside. He beats up the guard out front. And now this is like a trailer, right? What was this?
Yeah, I think it was.
It's either one of those trailers that's not ever going anywhere. And yeah. not that a lot of trailers ever do.
Or a lifted house.
Yeah, or a lifted house or, mm-hmm. or like a really sweet double wide. You know, that they kind of just try to make it look like it's not a trailer.
So the man who's sitting in the room that we see immediately, his name is Otis. And Beulah comes out. And apparently she's head of the house.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to make of her. She reminds me of Isabella Rossellini's character in Wild at Heart.
I haven't. It's been so long since I've watched that movie.
Well, it's like her gang hangout. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's something bad going on. Look at the place. And you got a guy out front in the middle of the woods standing guard. You know? It's kind of a...
Yeah, it's like some sort of like white trash, hillbilly, underground organized crime.
Well, if he's the opposite of Coop, right? It would make sense that he would have... It's kind of like his FBI headquarters. You know what I mean? Like, he's going there to pick up some nasty people. They, you know, like, he's just asking for a couple. There's bad people sitting in there hanging out. You know, so it's the complete opposite. It's his, you know, it just makes sense that that's his FBI spot.
The FBI doppelganger crew.
Yeah, you know, because he's evil.
Well, he asked for Ray and Daria. They eventually come out and... But before that happens, we got to talk about that guy that he beat up out front comes in, and that made me laugh so hard. The way he
that was a sweet move.
He raised his hand. Oh my god, and...
that's exactly what I wrote on my notes. Bad Coop with sweet moves.
Yeah, he literally hits the bottom of the shotgun, and it pops him in the face. It's genius.
I'm not a violent person, and I rarely, if ever, get into physical altercations with people. I couldn't even remember the last time I was even close to a fight, you know, and I'm in my 40s. But, you know, that would almost be a bucket list thing to do that to somebody. Like, somebody's coming up just to be that cool and confident and just smack the bottom of the gun and have the barrel of it hit them in the face, and they go down, and you're like, yep, all in a day's work.
Yeah, not even phased him. He didn't even look at him. Just kind of like, yep. Don't fuck with me.
And because of that, he tells Beulah she needs to put something better at her door. And she responds with, it's a world of truck drivers.
Which,
There's no trucks out front. I'm just saying.
You know, my dad's a truck driver. And so I'm taking offense at this. I don't know what she means exactly. It's a world of truck drivers. Like, nobody's good at anything anymore. They all just drive trucks. I'm not real sure what she's getting at.
Maybe this is a cryptic phrase being delivered to Bad Coop. Good Coop got his from the giant, and Bad Coop's getting his from Beulah.
From Beulah.
And maybe we'll figure out what she meant later. So Ray and Daria, as they exit, they hand over... Either it's like cards or some money to a man in a wheelchair.
Maybe it's their waiting room ticket. I don't know. Who knows what they handed to him. I was shocked that they had all their teeth. You know, yeah. It's like, oh, look, these two are actually cleaned up. It's almost like they don't belong there.
Those are
but
the ones.
You can tell that they're nefarious people just by looking at them, though.
Those are the ones that get let out of the house, you know. So it feels like it's a family. It's almost like the Texas Chainsaw family. And they're all in there together, and they're all just, you know... branches on this family tree of hillbilly organized crime up in the Pacific Northwest. Or that's where I'm assuming it's at. I don't know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
So now we're back in New York City. Tracy arrives again, and this time the guard's missing. And which this is my, I think, the first time I thought of Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive. And it's eerie. You've got the same sound design that heightens that eeriness of the mysterious disappearance of the guard. And you feel a little stressed out when you see Sam walk into that unnecessarily long bathroom. And
yeah, that would be an uneasy restroom to use because yes. I like my restrooms to be a little bit more cozy. I don't want the door right up on my knees or anything, but I kind of like it to be where there's not too much space. There's like a comfort zone for restrooms, and that's just way too cavernous to
see. It wouldn't bother me as long as the door locked. I'm good. A little breathing room. You know,
you know, as far as like Sam and Tracy, he seems really boyish is she seems more like a woman to me, so they don't seem like a match.
Yeah.
But it's neither here nor there. Maybe. Who knows?
Well, I have a little theory on all this. Well, I'll talk about it after we...
Okay.
Ah.
Yeah.
So, you know, now that he's brought her into the vault or whatever you want to call it, we learn that he got this job through school and that an anonymous billionaire owns the place. He is supposed to watch the box and see if anything appears inside.
Oh, he's watching the box, all right.
And the only really organic life I think that's in there is that bonsai tree on the table.
Yeah, if that's real. I don't know how it'd get any sunlight.
Yeah, all it has is that fake light from the...
Yeah, they could be high-pressure sodium. That would work, but do they ever turn off? You know, that bonsai tree would be huge if it was.
Yeah, there's got to be somebody who works a second or third shift, you know, divide up the day, because it's like that thing has to be going on at all times. Because
one of them's a bonsai guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so eventually she's undressed, straddling him, they're making out, and that's when something kicks off within the glass box. I'm sure that sex was a catalyst for some reason. What we see inside the glass box is some sort of form, which was both vaguely male and female. Definitely disturbing, definitely menacing. It breaks out and falls onto them and blood flies. It seems malignant.
God, this was truly creepy watching that thing in the box, you know, and
yeah. It looked like a cross of Marilyn Manson and a ghost, you know, when he was doing that weird no penis thing. Just made me laugh when it happened.
when Lynch crosses over into horror, he doesn't do it very often, but you know, compared to some directors who are just making horror movies, I guess he does it enough for some people, but I feel like when he does it, because he's not there all the time, it's super effective to me. And this was just like, on both viewings, I was just like, oh man, that would be creepy as fuck to just be like, what is that thing? So to me, this is a callback to talk about intra or interdimensional beings for sure.
Yeah.
So what's your theory?
Okay, so this is what I think happened. Okay. Now, this kid, I don't think this kid and the guard knew each other very well. I don't think he's been doing it for very long because he doesn't ask him by name, does he? Like Jerry or, you know, it was very, even in the earlier scene, it seemed like they didn't know each other very well. So I think he's been there for a little while. Now, whoever owns the building, the billionaire, has been doing this for a while. So maybe he knows that this kind of activity will trigger it. So why not pull the guard and then hire this woman, like you said, who is a little more mature to come in? Maybe he pays her. Maybe she's just, you know, wanting to see what's going on. But I think he hires her to have sex with him. To be the catalyst for this thing to happen.
I think you're right. Because you just answered the question I had about the Winkies guy.
Mm-hmm.
Who he works for is the billionaire.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because he says, tell her to do the job or whatever.
The guy in Las Vegas.
Yeah. All right. We'll get to that. I think you're right.
Yeah. Oh, good. That's Holy a great shit. Pull. I didn't think of that at all, and it makes perfect fucking sense now.
Right, because there wasn't any kind of, like, disappearing. The guard was just gone. So it's like, okay, now that we've got this kid planted, let's go ahead and pull him, and then this girl's going to come in, or woman. I'm not going to call her a girl. That's a woman. Comes in, and and then he doesn't have to pay her because she's dead. So it's a win-win for him.
Everybody wins except those two.
Except for those two. What a terrible way to die. I was just like, damn, they're like getting cat scratched to death. You know, it was awful.
that has to be what it is because now it makes perfect sense because they sit down, they start drinking the lattes and he's like, do you want to make out? And she's like, sure. So they start making out and then she pushes him away and there doesn't seem to be a look of desire or lust on her face. She just gets up and takes off her clothes and in a very like matter of fact fashion and then just gets on top of him, like cutting to the chase. I mean, they went from barely touching first base to like grand slam home run.
Which is what every college kid wants to happen when the girl asks to just make out.
Of course, yeah.
That's where our heads go. Most girls are like, I said just make out, dude.
Yeah, what do you right? watch your hands there, bud. You know, but she's just like, yeah, we're going to go for the gold right now.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Does the box have a door? You want to make out in the box?
Ugh. Yeah. So that billionaire is the anonymous billionaire who set up this.
Whoever it is.
Yeah. And it would make sense if he's in cahoots with Mr. C because he has to, like, how else would he know about the Black Lodge in the first place? So he's setting up some sort of thing to, like, either document or trap or just find a way in. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to mess with that?
It would explain funding, how Mr. C has done, possibly lived the way he has, you know, and somebody's funding him to just do whatever.
Yeah.
It's Bob. It's Bob the millionaire.
Well, I want to talk about him again when we get to part two, because it's possible maybe he's not working with Mr. C, but maybe against him.
No, okay. I can go with that.
All right, so we've got some theories in place, and now we're going to move on to Buckhorn, South Dakota. And this is where we meet Marjorie and her dog. And she can't get her neighbor Ruth to answer her apartment door. And immediately I was like, oh, Ruth is the name of Betty's aunt from Mulholland Drive. Betty, played by Naomi Watts. Okay. So we'll say that for now. But, you know, the lady's name that lives next door is actually Ruth Davenport. Marjorie calls the police because she detected a smell, as well as her dog also detected the smell. And so then the cops eventually are on the scene, and there's this whole...
The most patient cops in the entire world. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, the hunt for the key is just like, what's the word? Not shenanigans.
Frustrating.
Yeah, frustrating is the word that comes to mind.
And everybody's acting creepy to boot. It's like human knee. Yeah, everybody that lives in this building is a suspect at that point.
So Max Perlish is playing the maintenance man, Hank. And there's some really funny lines that happen here, too, because he's confused. He thinks that these guys are onto him for something because he's up to no good. And he's just like, how do you know? But and it was really funny when it gets to the point where they start talking about Chip. And they want to call Chip.
He's like, Chip ain't got no phone. It's just like they should know that, you know, mm-hmm. Like, come on, guys. Everyone knows Chip doesn't have a phone. Jesus Christ.
I think when they first summoned him, he was all, what the hell?
Oh, yeah. There's nothing illegal in this garbage bag, I swear.
Yeah.
Let's just talk.
It's like
a medical bag or something like that is what it looked like.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that and the garbage bags. I think he sets it down.
The classic guilty guy thing, you know, like the cops show mm-hmm. up at your doorstep and they're just going to ask you if you've seen any suspicious activity in the neighborhood, and you open the door and go, there's no bodies in my trash can out back. Yeah. I promise you that. What do you need, officer?
Yeah, it'd be a perfect meme when you're the creepy guy that's suspicious in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the cops are looking.
So now when the officers are in the apartment, this definitely recalls Mulholland Drive. As they walk further into the apartment down the hallway to the woman's room, Ruth's room, the bed looked wrong.
Yeah, it looks like there's three people in there.
It just shouldn't mm-hmm. be humped like that.
That big, yeah.
So now we cut back to the maintenance man, and he's on the phone, and he's calling Harvey. And as you listen to the conversation, this makes me think of Bobby and Mike and their dealings with Leo from Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm.
I can see that.
So lots of nods to Twin Peaks here. And now back into the apartment room, Ruth's bedroom, we have two detectives. Detective Mackley, who was also a detective in Mulholland Drive. He's behaving himself for once because apparently he doesn't always wear gloves, which is gross.
Yeah, that's just outright disgusting. Like, you're doing all this. He's like, look, I've got gloves on. I would have gloves on from the time I clocked in till the time I clocked out.
Oh,
just
yeah, for sure.
As a rule. Maybe two pairs.
Shoe covers. I mean,
uh-huh. The whole not hazmat suits.
I'd be the bubble boy.
He's probably that guy that would be eating in one of those situations.
Oh, know? Man. Those people who are like totally unaffected. Yeah, you're like crime scene cleanup and you see somebody just eating their lunch with like ham sandwich on the curb and you're like, what are you doing?
So I bet he was glad he wore those gloves because I think there might have been some mold growth happening. Like, it just looked like there was something kind of fluffy coming mm-hmm. off of the blood there. It was disgusting.
Yeah, it's pretty nasty.
You know, aside from Fire Walk With Me, Twin Peaks is never, because of the format that it was on for the two seasons on actual television, obviously it was never very sexually explicit or too violent. And here we've got a completely different tone because we're on Showtime. So it's kind of nice to let, because Lynch's movies have always had that sexuality and violence, mm-hmm. and now he can put it back into his show. So I'm appreciating that. And he puts it in where it's necessary and where it's pertinent. And he's not just going over the top because he's like, I'm on Showtime. I can do whatever I want. Yay. Yeah. You know, he's not being silly about it. So
no, I agree. The gloves are definitely off.
So now we get an aerial shot over trees And we are now back in Twin Peaks, and Margaret Lanterman makes a phone call, and she's calling for Deputy Hawk. And she tells him, "My log has a message for you. Something is missing, and you have to find it. It has something to do with Agent Cooper." And she tells him the way you will find it has something to do with your heritage. And she says, "Goodnight, Hawk." And he says, "Goodnight, Margaret." And it was very sad. Mm-hmm. I think her tears were real.
Well, you know, the Catherine Coulson was close to death at this point, mm-hmm. you know, while they were filming it. So, you know, she's got an oxygen thing going in her nose. Yeah. Like, you know,
she's really sick in real life.
Yeah.
So yeah, she died during this.
Yes. Yeah, so, oh, wow. Yeah. She passed away. So it's bittersweet to see her, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm assuming that whatever's going on in the lodge and Cooper about to, you know, the switching mm-hmm. Coopers, if that's in fact what's actually going to happen, we still don't know. But, the shifting situation in the lodge has alerted the log, and the log started to speak up and be like, "All right, get on the phone with somebody who could do something about this. I got something to say."
So what do you think in regards to his heritage that we've learned from the original series would make him the man for the job?
It could be his attention to detail, honestly. And I don't know if that is something that would do with his heritage, unless he was he was trained to be a tracker by somebody else, you know, that he was perhaps related to, which obviously would be a good asset to have as a police officer.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, do you recall the conversation that took place between Cooper and Hawk when Leland was dancing at the Great Northern?
Yes,
and he said, "All I know is that she's in the ground."
Yep.
What was he saying before that about one soul walking the earth and one walking in the dreamlands? There was something along those lines that he said. Cooper was asking him about his customs. What did they believe?
So if we're going to look at it like that, which is a better idea, then it's probably his idea of some sort of duality between, you know, everybody being alive in this plane and alive in another plane at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you've got your physical corporeal self and then your spiritual self. That's so looked at it from that point of view, he's the person to pick to try to see what's missing in this whole situation.
Okay, I have some ideas on that, but I'll have to wait till we get to episodes 3 and 4.
Okay, cool. Now we're back to the Buckhorns Sheriff's Department, and Constance gets a fingerprint hint and alerts Detective Mackley, and it's Bill Hastings, a high school principal, who is played by Matthew Lillard. And we see his driver's license at first, and I didn't recognize it as Matthew Lillard at first.
Me either.
So when I saw him, I was shocked.
Right.
And I'm not being critical of the fact that he's aged. I'm shocked because I'm aging, and it made me feel old.
It seems like David Lynch and them did this intentionally, because if you notice, everybody in the show is graying except for Cooper. So it's almost like they want you to feel the time even longer than it has been already. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Because I thought about this. It's like, why didn't they dye some of these guys' hair and you can kind of make them look younger? Some people would have done it naturally. So it's almost like he told them, you know, make sure all the gray and everything is coming in. Don't do anything because we want you to feel older. And throwing Lillard in like that, who if you put a hat on him, he wouldn't look as old. You know, that gray hair, it shocked me also. You know, that's when I started noticing that everybody else was looking older, even though they are.
He's 47. Yeah, I think mm-hmm. you're right, because his wife later, you can, I could see her age spots around her face. And I think most of the time actresses would hide that.
Mm-hmm. So maybe makeup.
But what I thought was cool on Bill Hastings' driver's license, he lives on Elm Street. And the first time I ever saw Matthew Lillard was in Scream, which is a Wes Craven film.
Oh, nice.
So.
And Wes Craven did A Nightmare on Elm Street.
And Scream.
What? No, I'm kidding.
You don't say.
So we have a scene where the detectives arrive at Bill Hastings' house, and he's being carted off to jail. And his wife's like, "But the Morgans are coming for dinner."
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you have other things you should be worrying about at this point.
And Bill Hastings says for her to call George and tell him where I am.
Well, she's going to call him, all right.
Mm-hmm.
So now back at the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department, Hawk is now in the conference room with two boxes of case files / evidence marked with red X's. Lucy and Andy are brought into the room, and we learn about their son, Wally, who has the same birthday as Marlon Brando. And this somehow applies to them expressing how they haven't seen Agent Dale Cooper in more than 24 years because it's been since before Wally was born. And is Wally named after Waldo?
But those two, it wouldn't surprise me.
Birdie, birdie, birdie.
We're going to name him after the bird that was shot in here.
Back at Buckhorn, Don Harrison, a detective from the state police in Rapid City, he arrives on the scene and it's Detective Mackley asks him if he's taking the case. And he says, no, I'm just here to help. And I think this is, you know, a nod back to when Cooper arrived in Twin Peaks and Harry and Cooper met for the first time. And it was a very friendly meeting, mm-hmm. which a lot of times you see that there's a lot of conflict between other departments working together.
Yeah.
And so it comes down to who should question him. And Detective Harrison thinks that it would be better if Detective Mackley interviewed Bill Hastings or interrogated Bill Hastings because he knows him. So we have this really great scene that I really showed off Matthew Lillard's acting skills because you can tell he's definitely holding back truth. Mm-hmm. The way he holds his upper lip, it's like he's retaining information or something.
The first time I watched the scene, I honestly thought that he didn't know what was going on at all.
Yeah.
The second time I watched it, I could tell totally that he's trying to hide the fact that, like, I still don't believe that he killed
Ruth.
But
no, uh-uh.
I feel like because I feel like that was actually Mr. C, because if you look at the exit wounds of the bullet holes, but you know, we're gonna get to that mm-hmm. later on. But I mean, it's at any rate, I feel like in the second watch, you could totally tell that he's trying not to divulge the information that he's having an affair with mm-hmm. with Betty. So, and it becomes pretty obvious, and I'm kind of kicking myself going, okay, why didn't I catch this the first time around? Stupid.
But right. I didn't catch it either until the second watch myself, man. Don't feel bad.
I was just so caught up in it being Twin Peaks again that it's just like, you know.
That, and I kept staring like him at how old he looked. You know, I was like, God, fucking old. Guess I am too, though.
So we have a quick cutaway from this, which is another nod to Twin Peaks, because we have, I believe it's Detective Harrison asking the local police officer if they've gotten a warrant yet. And he says any minute the judge was up the mountain. So the local judge in Twin Peaks wasn't always in town because he was traveling and all that stuff. So I thought that was cool. So now we're back with Bill Hastings. And this scene's really, really important. And I believe he is telling the truth most of the time from this point on, specifically about his schedule. So in regards to Thursday, especially, he left the meeting at 9:30, got home at 10:15 to 10:20 approximately. And then when Detective Mackley asked him, well, how long does it usually take you to drive home? You see it dawn on Bill Hastings mm-hmm. like, oh, shit, that took me longer to get home than it normally does. So I think there's like blanked out for a period of time. Yeah. He doesn't have memory, and he's just not made the connection that it took him 45 to 50 minutes to get home that night.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when he recalls, oh, I had to give Betty a ride home. Something wrong with her, something car, something wrong is what he says. Betty, a character also from Mulholland Drive, who her aunt was Ruth, and Ruth in this show has been shot in the face. Okay, so she's a definite point of interest we need to keep paying attention to anytime anything that alludes to her comes up. And also the phrase, something is wrong. So we'll keep paying attention to that throughout this entire Return of Twin Peaks, okay? So the reason why also I'm bringing up Mulholland Drive, because not only because her name is Betty, because when he says something is wrong with her, something car, the opening of Mulholland Drive involves a car crash. It's a signpost for sure.
Yeah.
So just the only thing about this loss of time, that 45 or 50 minutes, that has to be, if he can't account for that time, honestly, somebody took over, you know?
Right.
So I'm assuming that's Bob. Yeah. I mean, all roads lead back to Bob.
I mean,
okay. So is Bad Suit not Bob?
No, I think Bob took over.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that in part two.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got reasons for that once we get to the second part.
All right.
So Bob is not Bad Coop.
No.
That gets confusing, and we can, I mean, if you want to get into it now or then,
no,
it
because
it,
at that, in that one flash scene from the end of the second season, it shows Bob and Bad Cooper like laughing with each other and stuff
in the mirror.
Yeah. In the doppelganger. Yeah.
But then
I think it's two separate different entities. Yeah.
Okay. See, I have a tendency to believe that too. But then the very last scene is How's Annie, where he smacks his head against the mirror and you see he looks in the reflection and sees Bob, which right. has always
Bob
been.
Bob has the power to take over the doppelganger too. I mean, he could jump into anything, right? So why not go in the doppelganger in that scene?
So the doppelgangers are independent and Bob can go into them at will.
Yeah, that's the way I look at it. That's the way I look at it. So it would make sense.
He could be like the doppelganger king, kind of. Like he's the negative side of everybody. He's present to some extent.
I think he's mm-hmm. every doppelganger. Like every dark doppelganger.
Yeah. I think he's the reason why the doppelganger was made. I think it's his buddy. Kind of like the one-armed man was at one time. Kind of like, what's his name? Laura's dad, how he needs kind of like a friend. That's why the guy that, what's her name's dad that runs the lodge? He makes friends with these people and then it affects them. So I think that the doppelganger is just guaranteed evil that he could have fun with.
Yeah. Well, see, I don't know a lot about Egyptian mythology, but I know there's like the seven, what is it like? The souls of Egypt. I think there's seven of them and one of them's called, because there's like Ba, there's Ka. And like Ka is like released. It's like your double that's released in a dream state. So maybe he's like the Ka of a double doppelganger.
Yeah.
Like of all like dark, all dark doppelgangers, their Ka is Bob.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that.
Yeah, I can go with that. It's as reasonable as anything else because, I mean, you do see both of them together as separate things in mm-hmm. in the Black Lodge, but then there's the mirror scene that kind of complicates things. But I think I'm going to take a middle of the road on this, and what I think is that every doppelganger is individual and they have their own tendencies. They're the opposite of whoever their reciprocating counterpart is, and Bob can be kind of ride in them at will and take them over at will to, you know, when he wants to do something. But when he's not mm-hmm. in them, so to speak, they operate independently and have their own MOs.
Are they his children then, like his progeny?
Yeah, because it seems like whenever someone goes into the lodge, a doppelganger is formed, you know, because even, this is part two stuff.
Yeah, let's wait, because I think this is, because you and I have talked about some things when we were writing these notes, and that's probably...
All right.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
We'll just save it for part two. So stick around, guys.
All right. So Bill Hastings is escorted to his jail cell. And now we have a scene where the detectives arrive to the Hastings household. And there's a cool ass knocker that nobody ever decides to use.
Yeah.
And they have a warrant to search the house as well as the Volvo. And we have the detectives looking in the Volvo trunk, and Detective Mackley's flashlight isn't working correctly. It's strobing instead of a nice steady light, which is intentional nod toward his own work. Because before, when it was like accidental and just go ahead and using it and not repairing a light bulb or whatever, they just go ahead and just manufacture this strobing light, which I thought was cool. So at the bottom of the trunk, there's, what is that? Skin? Pork rind? I don't know.
I'm going with skin.
For sure. That was like, I mean, the problem was you couldn't tell where it came from, like what part of the body, you know, and you figure that wasn't it's just nasty.
So he was, so this kind of shows you that during that period of time where he was like he lost time.
Yeah.
And Bob took over is what I'm assuming. See, I was thinking that maybe earlier in the episode, I was thinking maybe it was Mr. C that did the killing because of the exit wounds in the face and stuff that are similar. But why is there like pieces of body in his car? So
because if there's two different people, then Bob's going to use that. Because I took it that body in the bed, that there was a head and a different body than the head. So they had to transport the Ruth's body somewhere.
Could be both of them. It could be Hastings and Mr. C working together. So then it would be Bob and a doppelganger.
Bob and the doppelganger.
Hastings is being framed just like Leland was.
For sure.
Yeah.
So whatever happened with Betty happened that night, and his car was used, and that's how the skin ended up in there.
Yeah, like a little piece from the neck when they cut the head off.
Giblets.
Oh, fuck. Ugh. Disgusting. Oh, it was so gross. It's like, oh, they went there. It's nasty. And it's so simple, but so effective.
It actually did the job better than if there would have been like a hand or
Or even a body itself.
Yeah. just because it's like, okay, everything looks innocuous, and then you lift up the cooler, and it's like, ew.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nasty.
All right. Well, that is the end of part one. Breaking these up into parts for our coverage, part two will be available to you within moments, hopefully, depending on how fast I edit.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe not.
Won't be moments, but soon after, part two will be available. Okay, so we're not going to have a feedback section for part one today because everybody that wrote in were commenting on both part one and part two because it was released as a two-hour premiere. So stay tuned for the feedback section at the end of part two. And for those of you who want to write in feedback in the future, this is how our schedule is going to be. For the next 4 weeks, we are going to be recording on Fridays because we are covering three podcasts currently. So, but after a month, we're actually going to be able to release these sooner. So for the meantime, feedback deadline is Fridays, 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Write in to noshipnetwork@gmail.com, or you can go to our webpage, noship.net, and go to our contact page, and that will help you find us as well. And thanks to John Bernardi for giving us a suggestion for our new sign-off.
All right, so this has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Is this thing on?